yes. And Warner Hall is the administration building.
That's the administration building, yeah.
Wow. Looks like it's, what, about 9 or 10 stories, it seems.
It's only six.
Six stories?
Well, there's two stories below ground, and that's not counting as below ground.
Yes. I was going to ask you, now is a good time, too, to... I'll ask one other question, then we'll go back to your family. But 1956, you became president of the ACS, and I guess you were president-elect in 55, and then the way they work it. And I was wondering what your recollections of that year were. Who were the people you enjoyed working with at ACS, and who were the people you didn't?
I was very active in the... I was been on the board of ACS for quite a while. I don't know how many years before I was president-elect. I had been on the council for many years as a counselor from the Pittsburgh section. I had been chairman of the Pittsburgh section and got the Pittsburgh section award 1 year. I was a member of the... Do you know anything about the Hancock Report?
No.
In ACS?
No.
Well, it's a historic document. We developed in the council of the ACS, God, I don't remember how many years before I was president, a what you'd call a Young Turk organization. Old Charlie...
Parsons.
Parsons was a dictator. He ruled the roost with an iron hand. He'd make the nominations for president and for everything else. And council wasn't anything. Didn't participate. There wasn't anything like a democracy in the ACS. Well, we finally made enough noise in council, this Young Turk crowd, that they got, I don't know whether this was before or just after Charlie Parsons died. Anyway, we got a management firm in, I think it was a Chicago firm, Hancock, something, to study management of the ACS. And their report was the famous Hancock Report.
Mm-hmm.
Then we started a campaign to get the Hancock Report implemented. And again, I guess I was chairman of the council committee to implement the Hancock Report. So I was sort of I don't think I ever was ugly or disagreeable, but I was insistent. And we got a revolution in the ACS. It really was a revolution. We rewrote the Constitution and bylaws, and I was on that committee. And the council became a body that decided some things.
Who were some of the other Young Turks with you on that?
There's a guy at Upjohn, a chap from Upjohn, was well known, very well known, as a research man. He had something to... I don't remember these names too well. There was another fellow that was very active, who was from Chicago, and what the hell was his name? He was a little too nasty sometimes. He didn't, you get things done if you don't call people a son of a bitch right the first time you meet them. And he was inclined to start out by telling a guy he was no damn good, and go on from there.
It's a hard, you have an uphill road from that point out, I'll tell you.
I don't know. There were people from Philadelphia section, from the New York section, from Chicago section, the Pittsburgh section. I don't remember West Coast people being very active in this. It was right along the same time when we had this whole business about what to do about Universal Oil Products Company and so on. Very, very interesting times in the ACS, really. And then, of course, Alden Emery came in. Alden had inclinations and I think probably a desire to be what Charlie Parsons had been. Mm-hmm. But this thing had gone too far that Alden decided it was better to join them and to fight them. If you can't lick them, why join them? That was his view. Another one was a fellow who was editor, for so many years of Chemical Engineering News. He had to have his come down. He was editor of Chemical Engineering News for, my God, I don't know how long.
I don't know. I'd have to look it up.
Well, we got, by the time I became president, the revolution was over, really. Things went quite smoothly. We had some good people on board. Ernie Wohlwaller. Ernie was the chairman of the board for a while I was on it. Roger Adams was chairman one time when I was on the board. Had some good people on the board. I was chairman. One thing that I enjoyed, and I think I did a lot of good for the society on, was that I was chairman of the publications committee of the board. And I started a summer seminar meeting of the publications committee plus the editors of all the journals. We would go to a place like Bedford Springs up here, or various places. I know I went, there's a little place called White Sulphur Inn.
West Virginia, I guess. Huh? It's in West Virginia.
No, you're thinking of Greenbrier or Berkeley Springs.
Berkeley Springs, yeah.
This is White Sulphur Inn. It's at Man's Choice, PA. But they had it. It's an old inn with a sulfur spring there. It was a nice place to go. I used to go there, Louise and I, and the president, W.J. and his wife, would go out there for a weekend just to relax. And they had built a stone building just with one whole floor of it. I don't know how big you would say it would be. For a meeting place for people. And then it had, down below, it had several smaller rooms. Well, that was a good place for us. The dining room was good, and they had a game room in the basement where we would meet for the cocktail hour. And those were days when was organic chemist at MIT and died and left his fortune to ACS. Art Cope.
Oh yeah,
Art Cope. Cope was on the budget, on the committee. He was one. Ralph. He was a pen man, wasn't he? Ralph. It was Roman Haas. What was his name, Ralph? He was director of research at Roman House.
Connor.
Huh? Ralph Connor. Ralph Connor was on the committee, I remember, at least one year. Then the editors, W.A. Noyes was editing the journal in those times. And We had the Journal of Physical Chemistry. We took over the Journal of Physical Chemistry and the Journal of Organic Chemistry when I was on the, running the committee. And we started a couple of journals. Nothing like they have now, but we, a lot of people were amazed that we were increasing the number of journals, anyway. But we settled an awful lot of things. We settled a lot of stuff about chemical abstracts at these meetings, too. Dale Baker was always there. And before, the fellow before Baker, what was his name? He started chemical W.A. Noyes Sr. started chemical abstracts as a supplement in the journal years and years ago before I was active in chemistry. And then it became a separate thing later. It was all, of course, chemical abstracts was a separate venture and a very important one by the time I was active in chemistry. Well, that was one thing I think I did for the ACS. It was
there the journal, really straightening out the journals. And
yes, well, that's right. And really getting a publications program that made sense. Conservative, but not too conservative. If a real need developed for a new journal, why, try it out.
I was wondering, of all the, you've won many, many honors over all these years, I mean, beginning in the early 50s and late 40s and going on into the 70s, there's a whole list of medals and awards that you've won. And I was wondering if there was, well, you had the gold medal of the AIC, and you had, you have over a dozen honorary degrees and the like, Horatio Alger Award. Was there any one of these awards in particular that you look at now and you think is being...
Well, I think the greatest honor, without any question, is election to the National Academy. I think of myself as being sort of a questionable case. I don't know whether having so many friends in the fraternity are the reason for my election or not. I know that people like Scatchard and Jack Kirkwood and so on were and Fred Seitz and Robbie was another physicist that I knew very well, and it's surprising, you know, that the guy that called me when I was elected to the Academy, the first guy to call me was Robbie. Imagine that, a physicist calling
me. Wow.
Robbie was a... He was a... A man of good humor too, a lot of fun. We were on the general advisor went at the AEC together for quite a number of years. So I served 12 years on the, two 6-year terms on the general advisory committee. And Robbie was on a part of that time. I remember we were visiting around to see. We were asked again for a recommendation about this damn program of a nuclear-powered airplane.
Oh, yes, I remember that.
Which the advisory committee thought was a nutty idea from the start because, hell, you modest. We agreed with Charlie Wilson. His comment down at the Department of Defense when the thing was up was... talked about radiation and all that, and Charlie Wilson's remark apparently was, what in the hell are you going to drive them with, Unix? Now, we've been down to Oak Ridge and came back up to Cincinnati, Evendale, where General Electric had a big contract on an airplane and a nuclear airplane engine. And all of those projects were talked up by the contractors, but never amounted to a damn, you know. Actually, it just isn't realistic to think that you can carry that much and have any performance out of an airplane, carry that much weight around. All the shielding that you'd have to have, that ain't personnel, just didn't make sense. So, but the thing, it just about died, and then some damn laboratory would get their congressman involved again, and they'd...
And you became really familiar with this kind of politics and science time you retired.
Our statement was, the damn projects are harder to kill off than a cat. And we were coming into Evendale, and of course the GE boys threw a big party for us as soon as we arrived, the night before we were to visit out at the plant. And we had dinner. What's this hotel in Cincinnati where there was business and offices down below and the hotel is up above?
I've never been there.
Yeah, it's a pretty classy place. They had a big cocktail party and then dinner for us, and then we got in bridge game afterwards. Robbie and I playing two General Electric guys. Then we had a case of this Heineken beer. And Robbie is a good beer drinker, and I was a good beer drinker in those days, so we played bridge and drank beer as we went along. God, pretty soon the beer was all gone. They had to go out and get another case of beer. I think maybe it wasn't just the four of us, I think there might be four more that were nursing themselves on this Heineken's. Then we, I'm just taking up time. We were at a centennial of the Academy, and held in Constitution Hall, and the members of the Academy were lined up in order of the year in which they were elected to the Academy, and all in academic gowns and hoods and so on, lining up, and then they marched in, finally at the right time. Well, Robbie had been elected just far enough ahead of me that he was in the back of the section that moved ahead of our section, my section. So we were right next to each other. And he says, Jake, he started telling people what great prowess he and I had playing bridge with these GE people. And then he said to me, Jake, do you still drink as much Heineken's beer as we drank that night? I said, hell no, Robbie, if I did that now, I'd have to get up about 5 or 6 times a night. And old Robbie backs away in his Nobel robes and bows real low to me and said, I prostrate myself before you.
Well, I have two quick questions that I think will close our interview. One deals with your views on the university, and that is, you know, you've outlined what you think the national university should be in the case of Carnegie Mellon.
Yeah.
And just in your reading the papers and your contact with what's taking place the last couple of years, do you think that the American university is going to continue to be a great source of innovation, or do you think that as an institution, it will be somehow eclipsed by either the research, industrial research lab on one hand, and the...
I don't think so.
And the government lab on the other.
The government lab. I don't think in a important way that industry will ever support a fundamental research lab. The closest to it that we have, in my opinion, is Bell Labs. Bell Labs is a little different than the ordinary industrial lab. After all, they're running a utility. AT&T was a utility. I don't think, see, there has to be more applied. There has to be a bottom line, at least hopefully in mind, with a DuPont research lab and a Monsanto lab and so on. The government laboratories, unless they're direct, well, even take the Manhattan Project. We got Los Alamos and Oak Ridge and Brookhaven and Argonne and the Lawrence Livermore Lab and the Lawrence Berkeley Lab. Oh, these, sure, there's some good basic work going on there because of the expense of equipment, primarily. I mean, the Fermi Lab out at Batavia, Illinois, for example. I don't, no university can build those 500 BEV machines and operate them. So I think it, some of that sort of thing you have to expect, but national laboratories, government supported. But I don't think that taxpayers and Congress will support too much of that. I think it's going to be supported only under a lot of pressure, a lot of political pressure from the scientists or from the various regions of the country. The logical thing for research in government laboratories is pretty much like what the Bureau of Standards has been doing for generations, and that is filling in the vacant places in the tables. It's not creative, really creative research. It may provide data that a creative scientist can use, of course. Well, Fred Rossini was that kind of a guy at the Bureau of Standards, filling in the tables. The real research, basic research, has to be research that's trying to prove or disprove something, not just determine the heat capacity of titanium dioxide because that's a hole in the table of specific heats.
And so you see really breakthrough innovation taking place, really your creativity,
right,
is centered in the university.
When you're doing that, be centered in the university, really, by and large, except for, say, high particle physics, where you can't afford to do it and don't see any way of doing it in the university.
That's very good. One final question. We've mentioned your wife, but I was wondering if there you had anything to say. You have two sons.
Yes,
right.
The older one is 54.
What is his name?
William. He's William.
And he's at the University of Minnesota.
Yeah, he's professor of applied mathematics in the Department of Aeronautics and Engineering Materials.
Mm-hmm.
And he's a good applied mathematician. He's from Haverford, then he's doctored at Kennedy Tech. Then he went on the faculty at Brown for a couple of years. They had a good applied math group up there, Prager and his crowd. And then Minnesota hired him. He's been at Minnesota for a long time now. I say he's 54 years old. He's a good scholar. He doesn't want to get involved in very much administrative work.
And then you have a younger...
I have a younger one who is 51 this year. Or is he 52 this year, I guess. He's a general manager of a...
What is his name?
His name is Thomas.
Oh, Thomas.
Thomas Payton.
Okay. And he's a general manager...
General manager of a Lear Stigler, L-E-A-R-S-T-I-G-L-E-R, dash between... Stigler plant in Holland, Michigan. It's a plant making heat pumps and other air conditioning and heating and ventilating equipment.
Mm-hmm.
He's was trained at Carnegie Tech. He, about half chemical engineer and half management.
Mm-hmm. Very good.
He's a good manager. He's a good production man. He's just see, Lear Stigler was started. It's the Lear of the Lear Jet. You know, the executive jet.
Sure.
He's not connected with the company anymore, except that his name is still in the company. He wanted to go ahead making further developments of the executive jets, so he pulled out of this company. It's apparently a very solid, good company.
And probably a very innovative company as well, if Lear's name is associated.
That's a high-tech company, and my sons just started under order to double his production.
There
you go. Tom was the one that called me. He called me. He has a watch line, you know, so he called me today when I interrupted us.
I think we're actually pretty well through with the interview. Mm. We've covered almost everything that I...
You haven't covered my last 15 years as a consultant.
Well, why don't you tell me about it, then?
Well, if you're... You can drop that out if you want to. It's not chemistry, except for this higher education.
It's part of your career, so.
Higher education. It started, I guess, because of a notice that I got from being invited to give the Perrin Memorial Lectures by Tata Iron and Steel in India.
Mm-hmm.
Somehow the Ford Foundation knew I'd been in India, and so they asked me, my first assignment with them was to go as a consultant, advisor to a new commission in Pakistan, new Pakistan commission that was making a 5 to 10 year plan for higher education in Pakistan. I was one of two consultants. The other consultant was Herman Wells, who was president of Indiana University. So Herman and I were over there for I don't know how many months, but we helped them to design their educational plan, which the government approved. I was looking after science and engineering, of course, and Herman was looking after business schools, particularly business and I guess to a certain extent university administration. But anyway, we our ideas were accepted, and after the government approved it, they set up what they called an implementation agency. Part of the plan involved, for example, establishing a new university of technology in East Pakistan and another one in West Pakistan. And, of course, increasing their resources in both science and engineering. They have quite a few... University of Peshawar is really the only university that is organized like an American university, where, say, engineering college is an integral part of the university in its administration. The other engineering schools are separate colleges that are just affiliated with the university. Mm-hmm. So there's a difference, you see. The engineers are, well, the reason they insisted on being in a separate college, I guess, was that when they were in the university, they were so overwhelmed by the faculty in the humanities and social sciences in number that they never could get anything adopted, you see.
So they wanted their own university, really, technical school.
Well, anyway, that implementing agency, they asked me to have Carnegie Tech take on the job of being advisory to that administrative agency, that implementing agency as far as science and engineering was concerned. So we had a faculty member over there all the time, and then about once every quarter, someone else from Carnegie Tech, I would go over, or the dean of engineering would go over.
And this really program began in 1951 or so, when you gave those lectures.
That was the start, but this Pakistan thing came later.
Mm-hmm.
And that led on then to we got involved in the, as a constituent member of the group that helped build the Indian Institute of Technology at Kanpur, mm-hmm. down the Ganges Valley. We had a number of professors over there. Truman Corman was over for a year. Dave McKinney was over. Jack Fox from physics, Gary Durge from metallurgy were all over there for one or two years. And I visited a couple of times at Ford's request. Ford had put some money in it. Not, mm-hmm. It was mostly U.S. aid money. Then I was trying to think. I was back in Pakistan again later on this East-West Technology Universities. But then Harry Case, who'd been the Ford representative there, but another thing in that same area where I got involved was in Afghanistan. University of Kabul had a contract with USAID to provide aid in building their engineering college. And USAID gave the contract to the University of Wyoming or something like that. Well, it was so bad that the Afghan government asked USAID to cancel the contract. The Russians offered to come in and do it. God, you can imagine what that did to Washington.
Mm-hmm.
I remember Jim Killian and I were, Jim was still president of MIT, I think, at that time, or he was chairman of the board, one of the two. But Jim had been involved in this USAID work. They invited Jim Killian and me to come to Washington. Urgent, very urgent. We go down and we find out what this is all about.